From the International Science School Lectures, this is Barry Brook on The Future of Biodiversity in a Changing World. It is part two of his necessary but depressing outline of one of the greatest extinction events of all time. The cause is not an asteroid, it is human civilization. The science school ran from July 1st to 14th, 2007, at Sydney, Australia. Here is Barry Brook.
You're listening to Eco Science, lectures from the 34th Professor Harry Messel International Science School, held at the University of Sydney in July 2007. For more information, go to www.scienceschool.usyd.edu.au.
So at the end of the last lecture, I talked about the modern biodiversity crisis. And I also called it something else. I called it the sixth extinction. Because if you remember, in the past, it's commonly referred to as having five mass extinction events having occurred. Of course, there were many others, smaller regional events, or maybe ones that didn't quite kill as many species. But there were five really big ones. There was one at the end of the Ordovician period, another one at the end of the Devonian. These were really ancient extinctions. Then there was that giant kill where 95% or more of species went extinct at the end of the Permian 250 million years ago. And that ushered in the age of the dinosaurs. And probably the most famous one, which I talked a bit about yesterday, was the extinction of the dinosaurs themselves at the end of the Cretaceous 65 million years ago. So they're the big five. But now the modern biodiversity crisis, initiated by a new shock, humans, is being termed by biologists as the sixth extinction, because there is a fear that it's going to rival in scope and magnitude those previous five events. So in the context of the history of life, it's just another event. But in the context of our existence on this planet, we happen to be living in one of those events. We happen to be causing one of those events. It's going to have major consequences for the way we use the planet and the way the planet provides services to us, which we need. So if you look at a map of the world, if you look at the lower one describes some of the major biomes on Earth. You can see up in the north, there's the polar regions, the great ice caps in Greenland and Antarctica. There's deserts in the sort of mid-tropical latitudes. There's tropical rainforests around Central Africa, Central, South America, and Southeast Asia. And then there's temperate forests throughout Europe and North America and Southeastern Australia. There's a range of biomes. But if you look at the map on top, which is the lights of Earth at night, then you can see that humans are dominating the planet already, especially in Europe and North America and Japan. Almost everywhere you look in those countries, it's lights, it's people, and some parts of Australia too. But most of Australia, we've only got a few little dots there, so it's mostly desert. But what that conveys is that humans are already having a major impact on the planet. What it doesn't convey is that there's much of the planet, the tropical areas, which are also being heavily impacted now. So if we look at an area of the tropics such as Southeast Asia, that's suffering from major recent events caused by humans, and that includes land clearance, chopping down the tropical rainforest, burning them, clearing and draining of mangroves for new settlements, selective logging of very large trees. And then once they've cleared, they grow things like oil palm. And oil palm can provide various products that we use in our Western lifestyle. So clearly, when you clear an area like that, there's not much room left for the original biodiversity. If you look at on a global scale at forests, the red areas there are those that are being heavily deforested right now. So we're having a major loss of forest. And you can see the red areas are concentrated in Amazonia, Central Africa, and Southeast Asia. For instance, the island of Sumatra here, which contains many unique species, has had a major loss of forest just in the last 10 years. Perhaps up to 30% of its forests have gone in 10 years. And the island of Borneo, one of the largest islands in the world, is also now suffering from major deforestation. Whereas conversely, other areas of the globe, such as North America and Europe, are reforesting. So they were cleared hundreds of years ago, and now much of that cleared land is being allowed to regrow into forest. So those areas are actually drawing in carbon from the atmosphere whilst we're releasing carbon by burning and clearing tropical forests. It's tropical forests that contain most of the biodiversity of the Earth, well over 50% of it, just in less than 5% of the Earth's land area. Now, ecologists can make estimations about how many species are going to be lost when we clear forests such as tropical forests. So when we have like an isolated block of forest there, cleared land around it, what are the implications of this? Well, there are relationships that we've derived on the basis of different sized islands, which tell us how many species occupy an island of a given size. It's called the species area relationship. It's quite a strong one, and it's been shown again and again with empirical information to be quite a reliable measure of how biodiversity scales to area. And so we can use this to make an inference about how many species would be lost when we clear area. And from this logarithmic relationship, we can say that when you clear 90% of the original habitat, you'll lose about 50% of the species. Once you get right up to the very last few remaining patches of habitat, suddenly you lose a lot more species very quickly. But there's some resilience in there, such that for, let's say, a clearing of 50%, you've only lost about 20% of your species. Now, Singapore, and I don't know whether there's any Singaporeans in here, but Singapore provides an excellent example of how bad things can get in the tropics. So that's the original vegetation cover of the island of Singapore on the equator in Southeast Asia, just at the tip of Malaysia. It was almost all lowland primary rainforest with some swamp forest, which is in red, and mangroves, which are in black. So it was entirely pristine tropical forest. If you look at the relatively recent vegetation cover of Singapore, it's almost all gone. The yellow areas are urban areas, essentially city and suburbs and so on. These areas are secondary forest, the purple areas, which means forest that was originally cleared for crops such as rubber and gambia and then regrown later. And then in the central catchment area here, there's very small fragments of primary rainforest, perhaps only a few hectares. Interestingly, those few hectares still contain more flowering plant species than all of Great Britain. So it's a very diverse area, but it's been greatly denuded. And we can use this as an example to apply the species area effect and see what sort of effect large-scale clearance on a local scale has on species diversity. Singapore was settled by Europeans in the 1820s, and it was one of the outposts of the British Empire, and naturalists used to come through there and survey the biodiversity. And so we have very good records of what was in Singapore in the past and what's no longer there. There's a museum, if you ever go to Singapore, called the Raffles Museum of Biodiversity at the National University, which contains a lot of these specimens. It's a fascinating place to go. So on the basis of that information, you can make some projections. You use a species area model to project, if that is a relationship that holds, what happens when we clear the forests throughout Southeast Asia rather than just Singapore? So this was the information from Singapore. The two lines represent those extinctions that were observed and those which were guessed at, inferred, we say, on the basis of other species which we'd never found in Singapore but were found in nearby peninsula Malaysia. So we can use that information for the different major animal groups and some plant groups to make an inference about how many species are going to be lost in the 21st century. So if we look at current deforestation rates in Southeast Asia, it implies that about 75% of the forest will be gone by the end of this century. And on that basis, you can infer from the species area relationship fitted to the Singapore data that somewhere between 13 and 42% of all species in Southeast Asia will be extinct solely on the basis of habitat loss within this century. And what that means is at least 50% of those will be global extinctions, because at least 50% of the species in Southeast Asia are found nowhere else. Have a question? Phasmids are stick insects.
Oh, okay.
So generally the insects that were well studied were those which are sort of charismatic things that people want to collect, like butterflies and stick insects and so on, and things like cockroaches didn't tend to be collected.
How long does it take for us to start moving back in?
It's a gradual process. It's often called ecological succession because you tend to have a rolling succession of different species that form the colonisation process. To restore a mature tropical forest is in the order of 80 to 150 years.
Can they find the structure of the forest will be different to the food chain or the...
Yeah, you find that the species diversity in those secondary forests for many hundreds of years afterwards is considerably lower than the original forest, and often different sort of species have moved in. So you've replaced one thought with another. Depends on how much area the original forest is left. So somewhere like Singapore, there's probably a lot of species which are still hanging on but are what we call living dead. So they're below their minimum viable population size. You have these large trees where there's a few individuals. It's not a viable population. They're still physically there, but they're really actually extinct.
So of those 50%, lots of
if you've got a very small area left. So the species area effect is based on a proportion. But if that proportion translates to a small area, which draws them below the minimum viable population size, then yeah, you'll have more extinctions than that. So on a global scale, I was just concentrating on Southeast Asia, which is a particularly rich area of biodiversity and has many endemic species, so species found only in Southeast Asia and nowhere else. But if we look at a global scale, there are a number of areas called biodiversity hotspots. And hotspots are areas which have many endemic species, so found nowhere else but these areas, and are also suffering from major forest loss, deforestation, and so on. So you can see that it spreads throughout the globe, concentrated in tropical areas. Southeast Asia is essentially one big hotspot. It's got the Philippines and in Indo-Burma, Sundaland, and Malaysia. These are all major areas of endemism. That tends to be because these islands are a foundry of speciation. So they caused many species to emerge when the sea levels rose and there were lots of isolations. But there's lots of other species in many other places throughout the world which are also threatened. Sorry, my phone. I'm a wanted man. All right, so moving on. That was habitat loss. But there are many other things we also do to the planet. One of them is hunting. Of course, I talked about hunting earlier with megafauna, but that continued. So keeping on the theme of Singapore, this was the last tiger ever shot in Singapore. It gives you an example of what traditionally often occurred with large vertebrates, especially large backbone animals, was that these were the most vulnerable to hunting. They were often good for trophy animals, and they were the most quickly wiped out by human activities. There's also other things that people value in nature. So it's not just hunting. It may be collecting for the pet trade. So that includes magnificent species such as the Bali starling and the malio, which is a now a critically endangered ground nesting bird in Southeast Asia. It's the last tiger ever in Singapore. And they shot it. It's possible to maintain the standard of living, but not in the mode that we're doing right now. So we have to change our habits and our technology such that the way we're using resources is less intensive. I better keep pushing on, and we'll do some more questions at the end, so I'll never get through it all. So here's another interesting relationship. This is that, if you remember from the last lecture, we looked at the relationship between the body mass of large mammals, how big they were, and their risk of extinction. Well, this is a chart showing the body mass of mammals and the risk of extinction in the Pleistocene, which was when humans first arrived in these continents, and in the modern day. And you can see it's almost identical. So the majority of threatened mammals in the present day are large mammals, just as the majority of mammals that went extinct in the recent past were also large mammals. So this relationship is retained. It's a signature of rapid impacts of humans on biodiversity. So a famous biologist, Jared Diamond, termed the threat humans place on the planet as the evil quartet. And what he meant by that was four major factors: habitat destruction, over-exploitation, which includes hunting and collecting, fisheries and so on. The effect of introduced species. So we take species from their native area to a new area. They're invasive and they can outcompete existing species, or maybe they can be predators and so on. They can have a major impact. And finally, extinction cascades. And that's what I talked about yesterday when I was referring to co-extinctions. So we have the extinction of one species, which may cause the cascading extinction of dependent species, or the loss of ecosystem services, which in turn leads to the loss of other species. So we have these chains of extinction. But in fact, in the modern context, this evil quartet was envisaged in the early 80s. Now we could probably call it the evil quintet, because now we're becoming more and more aware of the effect of climate change on species. So on top of all these other things that were going to cause major extinctions anyway, we've got anthropogenic climate change. So you're going to hear a lot about climate change in the next week or so, but I think it's useful for me to give you some context about how the climate is changing so that you can appreciate the likely effects it will have on biodiversity. And then you can get all the gory details next week. So anthropogenic climate change, I would call the big unknown, only in the sense that we know it's coming, but it's unknown the degree of effect it will actually have on biodiversity. But we can make some inferences. So if we look at what's causing anthropogenic climate change, it's an accumulation of extra amounts of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. So if we look back at the ice cores in Greenland and Antarctica, we can reconstruct temperature on the basis of those oxygen isotopes. And we can also measure in the gas trapped in these ice cores the amount of CO2 and methane, which are those two lines here, in the atmosphere over that time. And in the succession of ice ages, we had the rise and fall of CO2 and methane. And in the present day, we've now got CO2 up here, which is well above anything measured in that ice core over the last 400,000 years. And we've got methane right up here, which is, you know, well over double the amount that's ever been recorded in those ice cores. They're major greenhouse gases that cause more heat to be trapped at the surface of the Earth, and so a gradual warming. Now, in the past, the changing ice ages were not caused, ironically, by a release of CO2. They were caused by changes in the Earth's orbit. This is what drove the ice ages. And when the Earth started to warm, it then started to release CO2 from the biosphere. So plants and the ocean and so on started to release CO2, and you got this feedback occurring, such that over time you got a greater accumulation of CO2 and methane, more warming, and you got a switch over from an ice age to a hothouse. Now what we're doing is we're actually putting CO2 and methane and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and kickstarting this process in a different way than it's been kickstarted in the past. But the effect is going to be the same. Instead of changes in the Earth's orbit causing a release of CO2, we're not relying on changes in the orbit. We're actually releasing the CO2 ourselves through the burning of fossil fuels and kickstarting an even greater hothouse. We're already in a hothouse conditions up here. We moved out of the last ice age 10,000 years ago. So we're moving into a new era of warming, the like of which we've not seen in that ice record. Why the what, sorry? Why does it go up and down? Yes. It's because of the ice ages, essentially. When it goes up, it means we're in a warm area and vegetation and the oceans are releasing these gases. When it goes down, they tend to be drawing in these gases.
And why are they increasing and decreasing at almost the same time?
That's those feedback effects. So we get a change in the Earth's orbit, which causes, after a lag of a few hundred years, the release of these gases, and then as you gradually get a shift where the orbital configuration of the Earth changes again, you get conditions where more and more of these gases can be drawn back through the environment. It would eventually start to decrease because vegetation would start to draw it back in, but it would still be, on a human timescale, it would be a very slow process. It would take thousands of years. Yeah. So if we look at one particular greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide, most important simply because there's more of it than methane, even though methane on a molecule-by-molecule basis is about 72 times more powerful than CO2. Then we were up to that point in the graph, well, that's around 2001, so we're just a little bit above it. We're at about 383 parts per million now. At the business-as-usual scenario of release of greenhouse gases, you know, if we continue doing what we're already doing, then we'll be up there. by the end of the century, which is so far above anything that's been recorded in the ice cores, that it becomes a major problem. Now, if we look at the temperature record, we have good records from thermometers, an instrumental record going back about 150 years, so back to the mid-19th century. If we do a five-year running mean on these records, we find it's pretty well going up, up, up. There is a lag period here where it seems to sort of stabilise from the 1940s through to the early 1970s. This was a period when we were releasing a lot of greenhouse gases, but it was also a very dirty industry that was doing this. So they were releasing a lot of pollutants into the atmosphere, such as sulfates. And they caused a reverse phenomenon to greenhouse warming known as global dimming. And global dimming means the Earth becomes more reflective to sunlight, bounces more sunlight off before it reaches the surface, and has a cooling effect. So we have what's called a positive forcer, which is something that traps heat, and a negative forcer, which is something that reflects heat or releases heat. And the trade-off of those two meant that we weren't getting any heating there. But then when they started to bring in clean air acts and they started to scrub the smokestacks, get rid of the sulfates, we got this rapid increase in temperature, continuing on to the present day. 2005 being the hottest year on record, 1998, which was a strong El Nino year, being a very hot year as well. 2007 is currently tracking to be the hottest year on record again. We can go back further in time using various proxies to reconstruct temperature, including those oxygen isotopes, measurements of the spread or decline of glaciers over time, measurements in the soil. We can bore down into the soil, and deep down that tends to retain the temperature as it was hundreds of years ago. On that basis, we can reconstruct temperature going back thousands of years, and we can see that at the current level, we're well above anything that's existed at least in the last 1,000 years, probably in the last 100,000 years or so. So we're in a new temperature realm already. If you look at it as a global distribution, on the basis of comparing the average global temperature from the 1950s through to the 1970s, and then looking at what's happened since then, in fact, in 2001-2005, almost universally across the globe, it was much hotter. And if you can also notice from here that there's a latitudinal gradient in the temperature change. So the polar regions are heating up much more than the tropical regions. That's because there's a feedback that gets caused when you increase CO2 in the atmosphere. You increase its temperature slightly, and therefore you increase its capacity to hold water vapour. Water vapour is a very powerful greenhouse gas, but it's also a very short-lived one. It's only up in the air for a couple of days to weeks. But when you increase the capacity of the atmosphere to hold water vapour, then the areas which are naturally drier are going to heat up more. Polar areas are naturally very dry, so they'll hold more water vapour because of the increased CO2, so you get this feedback and you get a greater heating in polar areas. So in places like Alaska, we've already seen over 2 degrees of warming in the last 50 years or so. The main reason the Antarctic has stayed relatively cool is it's getting a lot more snowfall, because it tends to be more water vapour, which tends to have a counteracting effect. And it's a much larger ice sheet as well, which tends to take a lot longer to heat up. So places where there's not much ice in Antarctica, like the Antarctic Peninsula, are those areas which are heating up most. If you look at changes in rainfall, in Australia, for instance, we've had some areas of the continent which have become wetter over time and other areas which have become drier. But a stronger trend is actually for more variability. So we have longer dry spells and more intense rainfall events. And we're actually seeing that recently. We've had a very intense drought followed by some major flooding events. That's likely to be the norm for the 21st century, and we're only starting to see the hints of how it's going to unfold. Another indication of global change is sea level rise. So sea levels have been rising, as recorded by tidal gauges, over the past century, probably around 20 centimetres of sea level rise. And recently we've been able to measure this from satellites and take a lot of the noise out of this data and show that there is indeed a steady increase in sea level as well. So that's another manifestation of global warming. This is mainly caused by the thermal expansion of the oceans. So as the oceans heat, the water volume increases, the sea level rises. That's so far. We're also seeing other physical indications of some strange things happening to the climate. There's the Larsen B ice shelf in the Antarctic Peninsula, which was predicted to take in the order of 50 to 100 years to melt. but in fact fragmented over a period of a couple of weeks and just disintegrated. And that was back in 2003. That was because of unknown processes in how these ice sheets actually respond to changes to the appearance of meltwater on their surface. We saw the first ever tropical cyclone in the South Atlantic. So this is Cyclone Catarina that hit Brazil. It had never been recorded there before. The configuration of the winds in the past had been wrong for it. And we're also seeing physical effects such as coral bleaching. As we get warmer events, such as through El Nino years, which become more intense, tropical areas tend to have these manifestations of events that have never occurred before, or very rarely, such as the bleaching of coral, which takes a long while for the reefs to recover. If we look in sum at all of these effects I was talking about, we have this major driver, CO2, which is a positive forcer. So what's that doing is increasing the amount of heat that the Earth can retain. We also have various negative forces, such as these sulfate aerosols. So this blue line is all those pollutants causing global dimming. So you have these counteractive effects. But the positive effects are overtaking the counteractive effects. And overall, in the past few decades, we're getting major warming because they're having many more positive effects, apart from the occasional volcano, which throws up naturally lots of sulfates into the atmosphere for a few years. It's possible, although it's more likely that it will instead cause a more locked-in El Niño cycle. So we may get fewer La Niñas and more El Niños, or maybe even a permanent El Niño state. But that's still very uncertain. There are some scientists, very few scientists, maybe less than 1% of scientists, who suggest that this is a natural effect and not caused by these greenhouse gases. These greenhouse gases are irrelevant to global warming. But in fact, if you fit the sophisticated general circulation models of climate, you find that those which only include natural forcings are very poor at predicting the changes in the last 30 years. For instance, solar output, which is one of the major potential drivers of climate, has decreased over the last 30 years, where we've had a rapid spike in temperature. Whereas if you have models that include the human forcing effect and natural effects, you get a remarkably good match between the black line, which is the observed information, and the model predictions. So we have very strong confidence now that this warming is being caused largely, perhaps almost entirely, by these new human effects.
But there are also factors which are natural. Is there any potential to influence them, reduce their volatility?
There have been some engineering solutions suggested to reduce climate change, such as naturally throwing up lots of sulfur into the atmosphere to essentially replicate what a volcano might do. But there are inherent dangers in that because sulfur tends to mix with water and produce sulfuric acid, and then that rains back down on Earth. So it's not an entirely desirable solution. Now, there's no reason to think that without policies to mitigate climate change, it wouldn't continue on its present course, because we have more than enough oil and gas to keep us polluting for at least a number of decades, and we have more than enough coal reserves to keep us polluting at this rate for centuries. And then there are these untapped hydrocarbon reserves such as shale oil and tar sands, which, if they become economically viable, provide a rich new source of hydrocarbon. It's been estimated that the tar sands in Canada contain twice as much oil, at least, as all of the oil ever extracted out of Arabia. So there's plenty of oil left if it becomes economically feasible to harvest it. A recent study released in a prominent American journal did some inventory studies to show how much CO2 we were releasing. And worryingly, it suggested that we're currently releasing CO2 at a greater rate than we've ever done in the past, and that rate has accelerated over the last few years. It's about the rate of change of the release of CO2 has tripled in the last few years. And now we're tracking above the worst-case scenarios predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change back in the 90s as to how bad we would be emitting. But we're actually sitting somewhere between the top range scenario and above the worst case scenario. So we haven't done a lot so far to correct our emissions. If you look at who's doing it, this is a recent figure out of the journal Nature, and it shows that China has just recently overtaken the US as the greatest emitter. In about 10 years, China will be emitting about 2.5 times the greenhouse gases of the US. So the US is responsible, and Europe to a lesser extent, of most of the greenhouse gases that are up there. But China and India, these developing nations who are starting to crank up their economies, will be responsible for most of the gases released this century. So it's a global problem. There's a historical problem from Europe and America, there's a potential future problem for developing nations.
You are listening to Dr. Barry Brook at the International Science School in Sydney, Australia. His topic is the future of biodiversity in a changing world.
The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, also made some projections about how various physical parameters might change over the next 15 years. This was done in the early 1990s. So they made a projection for CO2 levels, for temperature change, and sea levels. Now we can go back and look at how accurate their predictions were. And in fact, CO2 levels are tracking right at the top end of their projections, as I said. Temperatures right at the top end of their projections. And sea level rise is well above the top end of their projections. So sea level is going up much faster than anyone anticipated. What's causing these accelerating changes is probably what's called this vicious circle of global warming. And what that embodies is this concept of lots of positive feedbacks. So you get one change which reinforces another change, which reinforces the original change, and so on, because it's quite a connected system. So you have an increase in global warming caused by these release of greenhouse gases, which causes changes such as a decrease in planktonic growth, which tends to draw down carbon dioxide. We have other processes such as deforestation, and which loss of tropical forests, which can cause a greater release of CO2. Melting of the permafrost up in the boreal regions can also release methane and CO2, and so enhance global warming. And another major one is a decrease in the reflectivity of the Earth's surface on average. As we lose our polar ice caps, we tend to have a duller Earth, which absorbs more heat. So like a black surface versus a white surface becomes much hotter in the sun. Decrease of ozone was caused by the release of chlorofluorocarbons, which are a very powerful greenhouse gas, but there's relatively few of them. But what that did was actually, ironically, although it caused an erosion of the ozone layer, which increased the amount of radiation reaching the surface, it actually caused a slight cooling of the Earth's surface. So it had this slight negative effect on global warming. But now we're also getting a major positive effect of these CFCs, which remain in the atmosphere for 100 years or so. Carbon dioxide doesn't affect the ozone layer, no.
Are there any other negative feedbacks?
Any other negative feedbacks?
Yeah.
The major one is sulfate pollution, this global dimming and other sort of dust. There's also other forms of aerosols, we call them, and there's a whole range of aerosols which can cause reflectivity. And there's also cloud formation. That's a big uncertainty. You form more clouds, you can trap heat, but you can also reflect heat. And that's probably the most poorly understood part of climate change right now, is how cloud distributions and abundance are going to change. So we can use various models called general circulation models on the basis of historical data, much like I did with that species area effect, to predict changes that are going to occur this century. So the IPCC has summarised the results of these projections, and they suggest, on the basis of their latest report, that climate will change somewhere between 1.5 to over 6 degrees in this century. A lot of that uncertainty is embodied in our uncertainty about how much more CO2 and methane we're going to put in the atmosphere. So uncertainties about emission scenarios rather than uncertainties in the models used to make the predictions. Now remember, right now we're tracking at above that top level. So at a current business as usual scenario, we're looking at over 6 degrees warming this century. So there's clearly an imperative to try and reduce that as much as possible. About maybe 1.5 to 2 degrees warming has been designated as dangerous climate change, because at that point we get so many of these positive feedback effects occurring that it may cause runaway effects that have major implications for biodiversity and for humans. And a speaker later next week will talk more about dangerous climate change. So there's various scenarios the IPCC have come up with, and if you make these projections up until 2030 or through to the end of the century, they're all showing global warming, but depending on how much more emissions we're going to release, that depends on the severity. Remember I talked about that latitudinal gradient. A scenario such as the A2 scenario is suggesting that polar regions around the Arctic especially could warm by as much as 7.5 degrees this century, and actually, on the worst case scenario, up to 12 degrees. So at that point, you would have a catastrophic loss of ice up there, and perhaps a complete loss of the Greenland ice sheet. And a loss of the Greenland ice sheet would cause about 7 metres of sea level rise. So that's a significant effect. There are also predicted changes in rainfall distribution. Overall, we'll tend to have a wetter atmosphere, but some areas will become drier, such as the southern Mediterranean, southwest Western Australia, most areas will tend to become wetter. But this will also increase the variability of these rainfall events. Now, it's interesting to take a bit of a historical perspective on sea level. If you remember from last lecture, at the height of the last glaciation, sea level was about 120 metres below the current level, and global temperatures were about 5 degrees cooler than they are now. So it was around 10 degrees. So today we're at around a global average of 15 degrees. But about 3 million years ago, we were maybe 2 degrees warmer than that. And 40 million years ago, we were perhaps 4 degrees warmer. So we're sort of looking at those mid-range scenarios projected for 2050 to 2100. The equilibrium sea level at that point was up to 80 metres higher than it is now. Even 3 million years ago, when temperatures were maybe 2 degrees warmer, the equilibrium, so that's when the ice sheets had restabilised at a new level, it was around 25 metres higher than it is now. So we've got this long lag between what the projection for sea level rise this century is and what the final result will be. So we're going to be feeling the effects of this global warming for many centuries to come. And we get these changes in two ways. We get a change in the average temperature, such that we tend to get more extreme hot events. And we can also get changes in the variance, so we can have more, ironically, more cold events, but also more hot events. But when you put those two together, you tend to have relatively fewer cold events, but the occasional abnormal events, such as snowfall in Rome, which we observed a couple of years ago, and I think it was even in Israel there was some snowfall. But you tend to get a lot more hot events, many more hot events than have ever occurred in our recorded history. And these are the ones that are dangerous for both biodiversity and for humans. The IPCC has made some projections about, depending on the amount of temperature change, and that's not me this time, on the amount of temperature change, that's really going to dictate the degree of impact. So we can restrict it to maybe 1 or 2 degrees. We're going to see major effects. There's no doubt about that. We're locked into a certain amount of change, but it's potentially manageable. But if we let it get up to the sort of business-as-usual scenarios of the IPCC, then we're going to have major sea level rise threatening most of the world's major cities, and we're going to have many species extinctions and other nasty effects that you can see on there. We're seeing the first signatures of global change in the biological realm. There are some species which are exquisitely sensitive to temperature change or changes in the availability of moisture. A classic example is the golden toad and a few other amphibians from the Monteverde cloud forest of Costa Rica. These are species which there's very strong evidence to suggest have already been driven extinct by global change. And there's also the danger for the spread of tropical diseases such as avian malaria, which can also have a major impact on birds which would otherwise not have encountered this disease. But with increased warming, the malaria is able to spread to new areas. This is a figure produced by the IPCC which discusses ways in which humans can adapt to climate change. And it suggests that we can be anticipatory about it, so we can make predictions about what's going to happen and then try and do something about it. Or we can be reactive. We can see what's happened so far or what's happened very recently and make changes. So right now we tend to be very reactive about things. We've just had a large drought, so suddenly we start to talk about water policy. When in fact, if we'd been more anticipatory about it, we may have been able to put in place changes such that it wouldn't have had such an impact. But the interesting thing about this chart in this context is that this area is blank because natural systems can't be anticipatory. They can only react to what's happening. They can't guess what the future scenario for the 21st century is going to hold. So they're held hostage to this change that humans are invoking. Whereas we can anticipate what's going to happen, natural systems can only respond. So considering that, which natural systems are likely to respond best to this global change, are likely to be most resilient? Well, that might include organisms which are very plastic. Now, when we say plastic in this sense, we mean are able to change the way they go about doing things very rapidly. So this may be they change their behaviour, or there may be a shift very quickly towards a smaller body size or a different timing of reproduction. Things that can change very quickly, maybe not even evolutionary change, but just behavioural change or immediate changes in which types of body plans become more or less common. Those which can disperse easily are likely to do fairly well because they can simply move to areas which were once too hot for them, once too cool for them, but are now the right temperature as temperatures overall change. Those with high genetic diversity have strong adaptive potential. So they're the ones most likely, at least in the short term, to be able to evolve themselves out of trouble, essentially to keep pace with climate change by making physiological, biological adaptations that allow them to be more suited to the changed temperature or changed rainfall regimes. And that tends to link in with this idea of short generation times. Those which tend to reproduce quickly tend to go through more generations of selection, so again, they have more adaptive potential to change in response to this change in temperature and rainfall. And of course, those species which tend to be tolerant of human-modified landscapes or even tend to prefer these sort of landscapes will do very well. So things like the city rat and the pigeon and so on, I mean, they really like human environments anyway. Urban environments tend to be warmer anyway. They'll do just fine, but they don't represent most of biodiversity. So those species whose range is restricted, their geographical range is restricted for reasons other than climate, such as the effect of other competitors, they may do reasonably well, because if their competitors become extinct because they can't tolerate these changes and these other organisms can, then suddenly they'll have this whole new world free of competitors to reoccupy. So they're the ones which are least likely to suffer. But unfortunately, that's not the majority of biodiversity. So we're already observing some major changes in biological systems in response to climate change. They include changes in what we term the phenology of events. So that's the timing that certain biological events occur, such as reproduction. They tend to be occurring earlier than they were previously because the seasons, especially in the northern hemisphere, are advancing. So we're getting nesting of birds and flowering of plants many weeks earlier than has historically been observed. We're seeing some evidence of adaptation in a few species, such as this squirrel and a pitcher plant mosquito, where they're able to change the timing of their biological events to suit the new climate, but they're doing so at a genetic level. So we're able to measure those genetic changes and pinpoint the fact that this is an evolutionarily adaptive change rather than just a behavioural change. So it's something that will be inherited in future generations. It's not something that needs to be relearned each generation. We're observing range shifts in many species, and along with those range shifts, selection towards particular phenotypes, so that's the appearance or morphology, the structure of an organism, in response to this change. So for butterflies, we're seeing a movement. This is in a particular butterfly species in England, a movement northwards in their range, and some contraction of their geographical range, and also a tendency for long-winged forms, which can disperse more widely, to be evolved. So we're seeing evolution and we're seeing range shift in these. In other cases, we can build models to try and predict how range will shrink as certain restricted species can't cope with this new change. So we can use various information on weather and temperature and other variables such as soil type and other competitive species to build a model which we can then use to make a prediction of a future range. This is an example of a plant in the succulent Karoo, a very biodiverse area of South Africa. And it suggests that a lot of its range, which includes all of that coloured area, will be gone. So all the red areas where it will no longer be found in 50 years' time. The green areas is where it will persist, and the few little purple areas are those where it may actually expand into. So that's an example of a species that's going to suffer a major range retraction as global warming unfolds. Now, if you recall from the previous lecture, a range retraction is one of those factors that can induce extinction because it forces smaller population sizes, more fragmented populations, populations more vulnerable to the extinction vortex and so on. In Australia, there's a good example. A bird I've been studying for a number of years is the magpie goose, which once used to be found throughout southeastern Australia as well as northern Australia, but was hunted and shot and poisoned and is now only found in the tropical areas. Still quite abundant there. There's many millions of them. But there's a danger that factors such as sea level rise will cause an inundation of wetlands such as Kakadu, found up here. With only a small sea level rise of perhaps a metre, Kakadu would be almost entirely eliminated as a biological habitat. And, of course, that would spell the end of a creature such as the magpie goose. But that may actually happen sooner than the full extent of sea level rise, because magpie geese are also an important food source for Aboriginal people. Right now they're hunted sustainably because there's enough patches of habitat which are not hunted that it can support these refugial populations and maintain an overall viable population. But some modelling I've done suggests that whereas this is the current situation under no change in habitat. If you get global climate change occurring also, then this interaction between harvest and loss of habitat through to climate change causes a decline of these populations more rapidly to extinction. So you're likely to have these synergistic effects where one effect has a knock-on effect to another. This is a summary diagram of all of those major impacts on biodiversity that I was talking about. Most of them are projected to get worse in the 21st century than has occurred in the 20th century, especially climate change. So the upward arrow suggests things are going to get much worse much more quickly. So historically, climate change hasn't had that much of an effect. It's probably going to be the major driver, along with habitat loss, of biodiversity change this century. So flipping the coin, which species are likely to be most vulnerable to climate change? Well, it's almost the inverse of those properties that I put up in an earlier slide. Those with restricted geographical range are closer to the minimum viable population size, and any retraction in their range due to climate change is obviously going to push them closer to extinction. Those with a low dispersal capacity are unable to move to a new location where there's still a habitable climate, especially in the context of human-modified landscapes. So whereas we had climate change in the past, often quite rapid climate change, this was in a pristine world where the habitats were able to shift to keep pace with the climate. Now we're in a human-dominated world. A lot of it has been cleared for agriculture and cities and so on, and so movement of species through these modified landscapes is much more difficult. So those with naturally small population sizes, again, are going to be more vulnerable to small changes. Those with low genetic diversity, either naturally or because they've already been reduced in population size, are not going to be able to evolve their way out of trouble. And similarly, those which are co-evolved to require the existence of other species are going to go extinct if those species suffer particularly from climate change. So I guess the big question is, in the context of climate change and habitat loss and continued over-exploitation of species by people and chains of extinctions, how many species will be lost? Well, if you remember this figure from the previous day, then it's likely that about the extinction rate compared to past times will be increased by somewhere between 1,000-fold to 10,000-fold. So we're talking about many more extinctions than have occurred in the recent past. It's difficult to say exactly the number of species that will go extinct because we don't actually have a very good idea about how many species there are out there. If you speak to one ecologist or another ecologist, they may give you a figure of anywhere from 3 million to 100 million species out there. That's sort of the range of our knowledge. Certainly we know how many species have been documented. It's been about 1.5 million. So these have been scientifically recorded. But many more species, especially in tropical areas, and especially invertebrates, you know, insects and spiders and so on, they tend to be very poorly recorded. So there's a vast amount of biodiversity that remained unrecorded and may forever go unrecorded if it's driven extinct this century by these changes. This is a summary published in the journal Science a few years ago, which tries to take into account all of these effects to suggest which areas of the world are going to be most heavily impacted by human-induced change this century. The most heavily impacted areas are going to be the tropical areas, because these are the ones which have historically been the most pristine. Modern society has tended to develop in temperate areas, and we're now really starting to exploit the tropics like never before. There are other vulnerable areas, though, such as the polar regions, which are the ones which are going to be very heavily impacted by climate change, whereas desert regions will probably expand, and temperate regions have already been heavily impacted. They're the least likely to continue to be impacted in the future. With this loss of biodiversity comes a loss of many ecosystem services. Now, I did talk about this a bit yesterday, but essentially it means that biodiversity, natural systems, provide many of the services that humans take for granted and require, such as clean water, clean air, some intrinsic properties such as the fact that we tend to appreciate nature and feel good about ourselves by having nature. It tends to provide security against natural disasters such as floods, because when you have forested areas, for instance, that tends to capture water. There are many services which would be extremely expensive or difficult for us to supply artificially, that are supplied by natural systems. Now, as we degrade natural systems, and in many cases eliminate them, we have to replace these services, and that's a very costly exercise. So losing biodiversity, not only is it irreparable in the sense that once a species has gone extinct, we can never recover it, it's also very damaging to our economy in the long term, because we're going to have to step in and replace, if we can, many of these services that it currently provides. Okay, I'll turn now briefly to an area of interest of mine, which is trying to make predictions about the effect of many of these impacts on threatened species. So species which are sort of close to the edge of extinction already, how can we build models to make predictions about how to recover them and stop them going extinct? This process is known as population viability analysis. What it essentially does is take all of the factors which affect wildlife populations, and that includes the drivers that are causing their decline, such as exploitation and habitat fragmentation and so on, and then all of the properties of a population that causes it to function, such as survival rates and reproduction and social structure and genetic effects and so on. Many of you may notice this is a similar sort of figure to the extinction vortex, because the extinction vortex essentially means an enhancement of some of those processes which naturally drive populations, such that they become worse when you become small. But many of them are actually natural processes that drive any population. So we need to be able to model those if we're going to understand how populations will change over time. Once we do this, we can build stochastic models. Stochasticity is essentially a fancy word for uncertainty and variability. So there's uncertainty about how the future will unfold, but we can use probabilities on the basis of how the environments are going to change and how survival rates and reproduction rates are going to change, and use those to make predictions about the future. This is an example of a PVA model which was fitted to some historical data and used to make a projection to see how well it matched. So the historical data is the Heron Island silver eye, this dark shaded line, and the other lines are five replicate runs of this computer simulation model. None of them match precisely what the silver eye population actually did, but the ensemble properties of these tend to match quite well. So if you took the average of all of those, it actually goes through like that, and you have variance around it. So it makes a very good prediction overall about how the population will remain stable in this case, even though any one particular simulation is different to what actually unfolded. We can use these models to make predictions about future extinction risk then. So how likely is the population to suffer extinction as a result of these threats? And we can also use it to weigh the benefits and costs of different management scenarios. So let's say we had four different scenarios available to us. We could do nothing and just let the endangered species do its own thing. It may go extinct, it may not. Or we could implement scenario A, which may be supplemental feeding. Or scenario B, which is opening up a new habitat. Or scenario C, which is connecting a number of habitats with new habitat corridors. So each of those scenarios becomes increasingly more expensive. It's most expensive to connect habitat, less expensive to just build a new patch, even less expensive to supplementary feed, and of course it doesn't cost anything to do nothing. So then you can look at perhaps putting these different scenarios together and looking at the overall effect on extinction risk. And so in this case, the model suggested that only those combinations of either scenario B and C, or all of them together, would be sufficient to reduce the extinction rate to less than 5% in 100 years. So you can use this to make a quantitative judgment of how effective your management actions will be, and also about what it's worth doing and what is not worth doing. Because in other cases, it may be you only need to implement the very cheapest scenario in order to greatly reduce the risk. If that's the case, then that's fine, because you can use the remaining funds and logistics to deal with other threatened species. Here's an example of a species I've built a PVA model for. It's called the Carpentarian rock rat. It's one of Australia's most threatened mammals. It's found in the Northern Territory, in the Gulf of Carpentaria, around the town of Borroloola. There's a cattle station known as Woolagarang, and there's a few isolated habitat patches there, which is rainforest embedded within this savanna sea. And so the rock rats like the rainforest, but they can't persist solely in a savanna area. So they're restricted to a few fragmented habitat patches. This may be an historical thing, that they're always fragmented like this, simply because that's the nature of the habitat they exist. But whereas there's probably 100 of these rainforest patches found throughout this area of Northern Territory and Queensland, the rock rats are now restricted to only four of these patches. So So it seems like they've undergone a range retraction and are now close to extinction. Some of the new threats include changed fire regimes and increased burning in the savannah. And so what we did was we radio-tracked these animals, we built a PVA model, and we made some predictions about what sort of habitat they were using and what was likely to be the most damaging effect to them. So this model suggested that the frequency of hot fire, which is this red part of the pie chart, was likely to be most strongly influencing extinction risk. There were also effects from juvenile and adult survival, and the recovery of the habitat following fire was also an important consideration. So these were the main elements to concentrate on for management to try and recover the rock rat. Here's another way of looking at it. We can look at different scenarios such as no management or backburning of around the rainforest patches every 3 years or backburning every year to exclude fire or supplemental captive breeding, so introducing new individuals into the population. You can use these models to see what effect it has on extinction risk and what effect it has on the average population size. So in this case, the highest average population size and the lowest extinction risk was to backburn every year. So that's what we then went ahead and did in conjunction with the National Parks and Wildlife Service. We also did a historical study where we used historical aerial photography to map changes in the habitat over time. So there were photos taken soon after World War II of these areas. So that's 1947. Then some more aerial photographs taken in 72 and another set taken in 97. We're able to use GIS, which is a type of technology where we can produce maps in the computer and use that on a point-by-point basis to map changes to show that the habitat in this case had expanded greatly in contrast to what our expectations were for this rock rat. It expanded greatly over the last 50 years by about 70%. So this is a case where the habitat was actually increasing and people had walked around these rainforest patches and seen burnt trees and fragmented habitat on the edge and thought, well, this is a retracting rainforest. But in fact, what they were seeing was a rainforest that was pushing up against the boundaries of the savannah and expanding at a rapid rate. And it seems, ironically, that this is a manifestation of climate change, or at least of change in atmospheric carbon dioxide. When you have more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that tends to favour the growth of woody plants. They need less water to grow, and they also their photosynthetic pathway, which is called a C3 photosynthetic pathway, becomes favoured over a C4 photosynthetic pathway, which is what most grasses prefer to use. So, in this case, ironically, climate change was causing a favourable increase in the rock rat's habitat, and it's probably doing a lot better than we originally thought before we built this model and did these studies. This is an example of one of the habitat patches where we're able to build a habitat suitability map to say which areas are most favourable for rock rats and which areas are least favourable on the basis of these attributes such as elevation and slope and vegetation cover and drainage and so on. So these are the elements of the sort of models we use to make these predictions. And I've worked in Northern Australia for a number of years. I'm no longer there, but I built many models of wildlife populations up there to make these sort of predictions. So in this case, there was a suggestion to do safari hunting of saltwater crocodiles. And so we're able to build models on the basis of historical data to show what level of safari hunting would be sustainable. And it turns out you could harvest a couple of hundred of these large saltwater crocodiles a year and have no impact on population viability. Similarly, in Singapore, I did a model of the Indian house crow, which is an invasive species, because in that case, the Singapore government wanted to know how to get rid of the house crow. So here again, we were able to use historical data, build a population model, and on the basis of some new information we collected on roosting habits, combined with information on past culling and how effective, or in this case, ineffective it had been in controlling the increase of the house crow, what you actually needed to do to reduce them to a level where they were no longer a pest. And being Singapore, they actually did exactly what I said and implemented this major culling regime and have almost entirely eliminated the house crow over the last 5 years as a result of the predictions of that model. So that's another success of using population modelling to make some predictions and invoke a management response that has a major effect on biological systems. Final example, again from Northern Australia, is the effect of culling feral animals in Kakadu National Park. In this case, I built a spatial model, so looking at how populations move through the landscape, as well as how the populations themselves functioned over time, and looking at different culling regimes to reduce the impact of feral animals such as Asian water buffalo on the wetlands, and also pigs. So we're able to look at scenarios where you could cull a certain number of animals and essentially have no impact on the population, or you could increase the culling to a rate where you could cause a major decline. It's very hard to intuitively know what sort of culling levels are required to achieve these sort of goals, or indeed to reverse what sort of supplementation levels are required to recover endangered species without building these quantitative models. So they're a really important way of making mathematical predictions about how populations will respond in the future. So this whole idea of extinction biology and conservation biology and making predictions about the future involves a number of methods that help advance the field of extinction biology. And they include using multiple lines of evidence. So we don't just stick to one particular indicator of change, either past change or future change. We use all of the available information to try and make the best prediction about how the future is likely to change. Because only then are we going to get the most realistic sort of predictions. So the science of climate change, for instance, is not based on very simple models. You can use simple models to make some broad-scale predictions. For instance, Arrhenius, back in the 19th century, made a prediction that the doubling of CO2 would cause about a 3-degree temperature rise. So back then, based on a very simple calculation, which was nothing to do with general circulation models involving detailed mapping of the entire globe, he was able to make a fairly broad but reliable prediction about climate change as a result of increased CO2. But on a finer scale, and when the devil is in the detail, you need increasingly sophisticated models based on multiple lines of evidence in order to make the most reliable predictions. And to do that, you need a mix of observations, especially in biology. It's very difficult to perform experiments in the field, so it's often good to use historical data, observational data, to infer the likely drivers of change. But experiments are also important in biology, and in some other areas, such as physics and chemistry, they're paramount. So these are ways of testing hypotheses to advance science. The other way to do it is, and I talked about this in the last few slides, is confronting your theory and your observations with models that you build. And you test how well those models can describe past changes, and from that you can have greater confidence that your ability to predict future changes will be robust. This is a common theme with climate change, again, that we can be strongly confident that we're making reasonable predictions about future climate change on the basis of how well we're doing at predicting past climate change. And this was a theme from the previous lecture. It's really important to derive generalizations, because without generalizations, every new situation you come to, there's no answers available. You have to start again from scratch. Whereas if you have generalizations, which are principles which apply in many different situations, then they are useful for providing at least a first pass advice on how you might go about managing a system or predicting the response of a system in the absence of more detailed information. So one of the key aims of biology is to derive these broad-scale generalizations that can apply across many different areas, not just the particular system you're observing or the particular experiment that you're doing. So as future scientists, how can you make a difference? There are many ways you can make a difference. Now, what I've talked about has been pretty depressing. I mean, there's going to be a lot of changes in the 21st century. That's inevitable. There's going to be a lot of climate change. We're already locked into a certain amount of warming that's already occurred and will occur in the future, irrespective of whether we reduce greenhouse gases now. But we can make a difference in that we can mitigate extinctions and we can greatly reduce our emissions now such that we restrict future change to a minimal level. But to do that, you need a number of strong scientific bases. First of all, you've got to acquire the necessary skills. So right now, you're high school kids. You have a pretty good knowledge of basic science across a broad area of coverage, but inevitably in the end you're going to choose a particular field of specialisation and you're going to go to university and you'll study that. And the usual course is to do an undergraduate degree followed by a research honours degree and then a PhD. And all of these gradually ease you into the process of having more specialised understanding of a particular field and also learning how to become a researcher. There are many pitfalls involved, many processes you have to learn to become a critical thinker and have the ability to be able to test new ideas, validate predictions, and make predictions about how the future is going to change, all of which are really critical to trying to manage change in the 21st century. Part of that process involves publishing your work so that other scientists can read it, but also a key role is disseminating your knowledge to the broader public. So at the end of this science school, you're not going to come away as university-trained academics, but you are going to come away as science students who know a lot more about a broad area of science than any of the other students in your school. So it can be your role immediately to start to convey how interesting this is, how many things are still to learn, and then as you advance through your career, conveying this sort of information to the general public and to policy makers such as politicians becomes fundamentally critical, because without that information, change won't occur, business as usual will continue, and you've seen what the predictions of business as usual is. Part of the process of science, increasingly so in the 21st century, is to become collaborative and to engage with other stakeholders. So in ecology, for instance, there are many stakeholders such as National Parks and Wildlife Service who I've worked with in the past to manage threatened species. There are industry who may want to reduce their impact on greenhouse gas emissions. Science works best when it collaborates with people who are making these changes, who have the ability to make these changes, because then it's done so in a mutually beneficial and informed way. Fundamental to having confidence, to conveying confidence to policymakers about what sort of change is required, is to get the science right. So good science is at the core of advancing policy. And indeed, the climate debate has reached the point at which it's reached on the basis of thousands of scientists undertaking robust science to show the evidence for changes in temperature and CO2 levels and rainfall and the changes in biological systems. Without that information, no one would believe the changes that were occurring, and we would become entirely responsive to climate change rather than anticipatory. We need to treat the 21st century in many different fields as a crisis discipline. So something like cancer biology is a classic case of a crisis discipline where we can't wait to find out all about how cancer operates or how the many different forms of cancer operates, because people are going to die of cancer in the meantime. We can continually try new methods of curing cancer or of arresting the symptoms. In a similar way, in conservation biology, we're always going to have incomplete knowledge. Usually we're going to have almost no knowledge about a particular system, which is where things like generalities become important. But what we're going to have to do is not use that as an excuse for inaction. We're going to have to use that as a means of making a first step towards action and in increasing our knowledge over time. And we always need to keep in the forefront of our minds, especially when you're engaged in applied sciences such as adaptation to climate change or the reduction in the loss of biodiversity, is to consider what sort of practical solutions, as scientists, you can suggest that can be done to alleviate this change. So it's very easy to be a doomsayer and to be completely depressing, and in fact, I could give even more depressing lectures than this one. But there is an alternative, and the alternative is to say, well, there are paths forward, and if you provide the solutions for the path forward, then you will invoke change much more easily than if you just provide doomsday scenarios. So I'll leave you with the final question. Are all of you up to the challenge of this in the 21st century? Because we're going to need all of you and people like you if we're going to really make a difference. Thank you.
That was the second of two lectures by Dr. Barry Brook on the future of biodiversity in a changing world, presented at the International Science School in Sydney, Australia in July 2007. The first speech, Extinction Past and Present, is available from scienceschool.usyd.edu.au or from ecoshock.org. Just choose Species from the Audio On Demand menu at ecoshock.org.